What's up, OUXers? Today we're talking to Jeremy Keith, who is the co-founder of Clear Left, a design agency that specializes in building resilient, future-proof, backwards-compatible, and just super elegant web experiences. Elegant from a design perspective as well as from a development perspective. So let's just say Jeremy and his team write some squeaky clean code. Jeremy is the author of many very geeky books on topics like DOM scripting, so that's the document object model scripting, Ajax, HTML5, and he recently published a book called Going Offline with a Book Apart, which is not about taking a tech sabbatical, which I thought at first. It's actually about giving your users the ability to take their tech with them into the woods if they are offline by using fetching and caching and service workers and all that good stuff. But Jeremy came onto the podcast to talk about his book, Resilient Web Design, which he has made available for free to all of us through the Creative Commons licensing. And I listened to the audio version, actually, which he did narrate himself, through my podcast app. So just search Resilient Web Design to find it, and you can start listening right after you finish listening to this conversation. So Jeremy and I had met a few times at conferences, and our chats at those conferences and listening to his talks and, of course, reading his book, it just became very clear to me that we share many of the same philosophies. So what I call iterating on fidelity, which you may have heard me say before, and I've been saying that since 2013, since my very first talk in 2013, I've talked about iterating on fidelity instead of chunks of functionality. He calls this progressive enhancement, and we are both really adamant about strategic prioritization and encouraging design teams to make a strong, simple system that works first before layering complexity onto that foundation. So Jeremy is coming at these philosophies from a more technical side, and this conversation just goes to show that I have so much to learn from him. We all have so much to learn from him. I just really hope you enjoy this conversation at least half as much as I did. Okay, so before we jump in, I want to give you all some updates on the Orca process that has come out of the OUX forum. So this is going to be a new segment. I'm going to try this out. I want to start doing this on the podcast to basically start adding in any kind of evolutions or enhancements that the community has been hammering on. So the OUX forum is for those that are getting certified in object-oriented UX. They're taking that really deep dive. And in taking that deep dive, so much good stuff comes out of it. So the process continues to evolve as all of these smart people basically hammer on it. So for those that don't know what the Orca process is, it is a 15-step framework. Yes, 15 steps for iterating on creating a structurally sound object-oriented UX. And it's the process that I teach in the OUX masterclass. It's the process that I use with my clients. And it's awesome. So it is, I know it's 15 steps, but it is a very scalable process. So you can go through those 15 steps in a few days or a few weeks. So ORCA stands for Objects, Relationships, CTAs, and Attributes. And it consists of four iterative rounds, each round hitting on the O's and the R's and the C's and the A's, kind of at increasing levels of fidelity. So first we go through discovery, and then we get into requirements, then we go into prioritization, and then we bring it all together in the final round of representation, where we actually sketch and prototype and test that OUX before kind of moving on to interaction design and moving out of this ORCA process. Okay, so here are some updates. First, Michaela Hoffman of Cohort 4 discovered an amazing discovery in Trello. So we do use Trello for object mapping when we get into requirements. And she was trying to figure out how to link cards to be able to visualize conditional logic. So, you know, if like one attribute is conditional on another attribute. So for example, if I have a type attribute for a product, and there could be a type of digital or physical. And let's say if the type is physical, then you get a bunch of extra attributes like weight and dimensions and stuff like that you wouldn't get if it was a digital product. So that's just one example. We deal with a lot of conditional logic and basically different permutations of objects. And so she wanted to show that this attribute here is dependent on these other attributes. So she actually found, we were looking at power-ups and everything, but she actually found it comes built in Trello. It's just not where you would expect it to be. So if you click on the attachments, if you're in an attribute card and you click on attachments, you can link to the attribute card that it is dependent on, and it kind of pulls it in, which is very cool. Lindsay Claxton of Cohort 4, she found a ton of value in sketching out some rudimentary task flows to help her in her detailed CTA matrix while she was in the requirements round. So when she was getting into the spreadsheet and really breaking down all her CTAs, she actually went and did some very like chicken scratch task flows, process flows. So I usually wait to tackle those process flows until I'm out of the Orca process and really getting into interaction design. But in seeing how she was doing this, I can totally see the value in doing some of this rough sketching of process flows, as long as you're not getting into screen design, to visualize a user's order of operations. So if you're really feeling the need to sketch out a process diagram with some boxes and arrows and decision diamonds, go for it. During the requirements, for the CTA requirements step, that's a good place to kind of explore that, and you know, just don't spend too long there. But definitely don't hold back if you're feeling the need to do that. Okay, so Alexis King, also of Cohort 4, she recently asked a very good question, and it was something that I realized I haven't been clear about this at all. So what she was asking is, she was saying, do I have to wait until relationship requirements to get into junction objects and inheritance and local objects and all that kind of like advanced object stuff? And I realized, oh my gosh, no. So I teach it in the requirements round because it is a little bit more advanced, and it would just be too much too soon to get into all that inheritance sticky stuff during discovery. But that said, if you are recognizing junction objects, tree systems, any of those kind of more nuanced objects, if you recognize those during discovery, go ahead and capture them for sure. You know, even when you're during system modeling, if you're seeing those, you know, a many to many relationship, take a pause and think about if that relationship actually has attributes. That's a good sign that you might have a junction object on your hands. So the one thing that I would say is, if you are working with a team, if you're working with your business folks, which I hope you are as you're going through this process, if you're working with people that it might be just a little bit too much to start describing junction objects and tree systems and inheritance, just identify it. You don't necessarily need to tell people and explain to them what a junction object is. You know your audience, right? If you're working with developers, for sure, go for it. Get into all that complexity. But if it is, you know, subject matter experts or your stakeholders, go ahead and capture it. But you don't necessarily need to describe the labeling and the thought process around it. It's probably just going to be too much again, but like, you know, your audience, if they are more on the technical side and can kind of like think about those abstract concepts, then yeah, knock yourself out. All right. Okay. Finally, one more announcement. So Amy White of Cohort 1 is working with some content strategist on a website for content strategists, and they are using the OUX process, which is awesome. I'm going to have more updates on this project soon, and I don't want to say too much right now, but one thing has become really clear in her work with content strategists and working through this site is that in the OUX community, we need to be thinking more about how a content inventory and a content audit sort of fits into the Orca process. So I can definitely see this as an important input for noun foraging and attribute foraging. Like if you have a really great content inventory or a content audit, like definitely look at that. That should be input to this process. But I'm also seeing some interesting opportunities to actually flag attributes in our object map that need to be part of like an ongoing content audit. So for example, like a description field, being able to say like, this is something that when the data does come in, we need to actually audit all of these description fields. So conversations are happening around these ideas. I'm actually reading some really cool books around content strategy and kind of digging into UX writing and content inventories a lot more. So we will have more on this soon. Okay, so if you want more of these geeky updates and you always want to be in the know, please make sure you sign up for our almost weekly newsletter at oux.com/newsletter. And let me know what you think. Also, feel free to let us know at hello@rewiredux if you like these updates, or if you don't, if you also let me know if you just skipped on through these, but then you probably didn't hear me say this. So if you've skipped on through, anyways, feel free to let me know how you like hearing these updates. And let's go ahead and go talk to Jeremy Keith. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Jeremy Keith, welcome to the Object-Oriented UX podcast.
Thank you for having me, Sophia. It's an honor.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you about resilient web design. And so what I want to jump into is, so first of all, I'm just going to gush about resilient web design for just a moment. So I'm not sure how I stumbled across it, but I did, and I'm glad I did. And everybody that's listening should definitely, after you listen to this interview, go and listen to Resilient Web Design or read it. It is part of what is it? Creative Commons, right? So it's, you're just giving this book away free to everyone. I did listen to it. You narrated it yourself, which is wonderful. You did a great job with that.
Thank you.
And it's nicely chunked out into chapters, so you can get it in any of your podcast stores. So you can go as soon as you finish listening to us talk about resilient web design, go and listen to it for yourself if you have not already. It is chock full with amazing advice and also a very important call to action that we will be talking more about, as well as a lot of really great history. And I just love how you have such a good sense of humor too. It's like you're talking about some of the geekiest stuff on the planet and you still make it really engaging and really fun to listen to. My husband and I actually listened to it together. He's an electrical engineer and he found it really interesting as well. So,
oh, that's awesome. Thank you so much.
So even like with a wider audience, I think it's a really important listen, especially to get that context on kind of how the web evolved and how we got to where we are today. So my first question for you is, what motivated you to not only write this book, but also give it away? Obviously, you feel that this is a very important message because you want to reach as many people as possible. So what were some of the problems in the industry that you are recognizing that that motivated you to write this book?
Well, what's in the book is kind of a distillation of stuff I've been talking about for quite a while, either, you know, blogging into the void or at conferences and beyond stage. So like if you'd seen some of my talks from previous years before publishing that book, some of the stuff in the book would have been familiar. It was kind of, you know, put together by that. As to putting it out there for free, I didn't have any great plan. In fact, I did contact a publisher who I'd worked with in the past and said, I've actually written a whole book. You interested in publishing it? And they were like, nah. Which was understandable because it's not practical in the sense of being about a specific technology or a specific skill set. It's a bit more wishy-washy and, like say, about history and a mindset and a perspective. So I thought, well, I'll publish it myself. And I know people who've done the whole self-publishing thing with books. And the one thing that they all said was like that the biggest challenge was fulfillment, as in the actual getting the printed books into boxes and shipping them off to people. And I thought I could avoid that entire problem by just making this book a web book, as in it's first and foremost on the web, that the website is the book. So that's what I did. It also gave me an opportunity to practice what I preach and put everything mm-hmm. into action on the website. And then I also offered up a PDF version, made the audio version, like you said. What was really nice about Creative Commons licensing it was somebody else made an EPUB version. I didn't do that. somebody else said, "Hey, I like your book. Here's an EPUB version I've made." It's like, great. And people can make translations and stuff like that. So there wasn't all that much thought went into the self-publishing thing. It was more, I just want to get this out there.
And so for those out there that have not had the privilege of being in one of the conferences and listening to your talks that you've been talking about, going back to like what was the thing that you felt that was so important to get out there, and what were the problems that you were seeing other designers make, other developers make, that you really wanted to make sure to get this message out there because you feel like it's so important?
Well, all of my talks and a lot of what I write about kind of come down to this idea of progressive enhancement, which is an old idea and I think is treated by web designers and developers as being passé. But what I was seeing was that the more I was around the scene and the more I was seeing things get more complex, the more useful progressive enhancement seemed to me and the more it stood the test of time. So that was kind of the main thing. It was about trying to cultivate this mindset of building in a layered way, starting with the user need, addressing that, and then adding on, the bells and whistles and the enhancements, as opposed to the mindset that I see more often on the web, which is kind of more, from the software world, where like there's one final interface and that's what you're building, whereas on the web, it's this wonderful medium where the same thing can be experienced different ways, depending on your browser, depending on the settings you've got set up, depending on your internet connection. And on the one hand, that makes web development and web design complex and challenging. But on the other hand, it's kind of an amazing environment to work in. So trying to cultivate a way of going with the flow of the web rather than fighting against the web. The unknowability, the fluidity, the various factors that end users, are dealing with, to go with that basically. That's the message, is like work with that, not against it.
Embrace the medium, embrace the uncertainty of the medium.
Right, exactly.
So this reminds me when you said a layered approach to building. And it's funny actually, I didn't think about this when I was listening to the book. But my very first talk, which I think we also may have met at UX Week, maybe, but my very first talk that I gave at a conference, it was in 2013, and it was at UX Week, and I was talking about my work on the responsive web design of CNN election results. So they wanted, 2013, everybody wanted the responsive design case studies. And so I was thinking about, okay, what worked well for that project? What were kind of like the pillars of if I'm gonna say, here's the five things you should do for responsive design. What are those five things? And one of them was, God, what did I actually call it? Iterate on fidelity, not bits of functionality. And basically, what I meant by that, and what I was seeing, was sprints being divided up by chunks of functionality. In that, or even pages. That was what I was really seeing, is the sprints broken up by pages. So for CNN election results, for example, the first sprint was the state detail page. So like Georgia, California, Ohio, the state detail page. So you see all the results for that state. And I was brought on, I still remember, it was 4 days before the first sprint as the UX, the one lead UX designer, the one UX designer. And my team, or my project manager said, "Don't worry, don't panic. We just need that one page." Right? I was being asked to think about a cog in a machine without thinking about the whole machine. And I didn't do that. I basically, at a very high level, figured out, okay, here's how all these pieces are going to work together, because I wanted to create that reduced set of moving parts. And so I needed to figure out a system. And that was one of the things that I was saying, oh, like this is one thing that we need to be doing for responsive design. And then I realized that responsive design just forced that issue. We should have been doing that all along.
Very
Right.
much so.
Yeah. So there was all these lessons that kind of responsive design was the crucible of those lessons. And I just wonder if you have any kind of, and those are kind of leading to a lot of my other questions on iteration. And the so seeing people iterate, especially in an agile environment, is kind of like this feature factory. I'm like, okay, we're going to do this feature, and then we're going to do the next feature, and then we're going to do the next feature. And then often those features don't really hang together. So how do we balance this kind of like, let's think about the big picture and kind of think about where we want to be going so we can do that, sort of build that simple system before that works, before we build a complex system that works, versus this idea of like, we need to prioritize down and just sort of think about what the next thing is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And I think you're right about responsive design being like a forcing function. You know, people like to blame it for making things harder, but actually all it did was throw things into the light. Like, you never knew what size screen your users were using. You just all pretended that we were all on wide screens, and, you know, responsive design just made the truth more apparent. And if you were already building in a way that didn't make assumptions about screen size, network speed, whatever, then responsive design was not that much of a hurdle. If, however, you were building in a way that assumed a lot about screen size or network speed, whatever, then yeah, it was a hard change to make, but a necessary one. And it, you know, it's interesting. I talk about progressive enhancement being the main message and the thing I've been talking about for years. And Ethan is very much a fan of progressive enhancement. And I think he would say that responsive design is kind of an evolution of progressive enhancement, of building on what's come before. When he wrote his article in List Apart, was it about 3 years before you wrote your article, I reckon? I think this was 2010. And one of the first things he does is he harks back to an even earlier article in List Apart from the year 2000 or 2001 by John Alsop called A DAO of Web Design, which is all about this idea of going with the flow, embracing the fluidity of the web. So it feels like things are being built, you know, one on top of the other in a layered way, which is appropriate. Now, as for applying that layered mindset into, you know, how we work, I think you're right to bring in things like, you know, project management and how things are ticketed and how do we slice up the work. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, the I think the bias we have is towards what's visible. And so if you have a mock-up of a feature, a mock-up of a page, a mock-up of something, that's what we're aiming towards. This is the thing we're building. It's almost a quite comforting way to work. I think that's, yeah. Okay, I've just got to make the thing that looks like that, and then we'll have succeeded. We can tick it off the ticket. The tougher thing to do, I think, is to interrogate it. Say, okay, what is this doing? What is the purpose of this feature? What does this page provide? Answer that tougher question rather than just, you know, going ahead and building the thing. And then when you go to build it, say, okay, if we've established that the purpose is X, then the next question is, what's the simplest way to satisfy that? As in, forget about how the final thing's going to look and all the extra features, but what would the simplest technology be that would achieve the purpose? And you do that. You build it with the simplest possible technology. And the reason you do that is that the simplest technology tends to be the most robust or the most widely available, the most accessible. Mm-hmm. But then crucially, you don't stop there. You then go on and enhance, say, okay, now how can we improve this experience? How can we make it from just plain usable to delightful? What are the extra features we can add? And the great thing is, if from that stage onwards, anything you add won't be a must-have. It's always going to be a nice-to-have. In other words, if something fails at one of those higher levels, something like that feature isn't supported in this browser, that doesn't work on this particular device, it's okay, because the core functionality you've already provided for, you've already met that need. Now, to build in that way, though, it requires almost that you develop a sort of X-ray vision to be able to look beyond, oh, here's the interface for a component, to go, yeah, okay, but looking beyond the interface, what is the purpose of the component? What does it achieve? And I've often thought it'd be interesting, you know, you talk about object-oriented UX, and it matches very well with this component-oriented way of thinking that we're all doing now with design systems. Mm-hmm. I could very much imagine a design system that begins with maybe just text. Like, it's a complete design system of components, but it's just unstyled text. And then you add, some basic HTML. Then you add the CSS. Then you add the JavaScript. That tends to be not how things get done. It tends to be like, we'll take this component and we build it in its entirety. And often we build in the assumptions. Well, assuming this feature is available, assuming this network speed, assuming the screen size, whatever the assumptions are, they're built into that component. Now, if any of those assumptions fail, then the whole component fails. Whereas if you've built in that layered way of first asking what's its purpose, what's it for, using the least powerful technology to begin with, and then layering on the more complex stuff, then you've built something that's more resilient.
And that's what you mean by the best way to be future friendly is to be backwards compatible.
Yeah, that this it sounds counterintuitive, but by using the oldest, most boring technologies for your most crucial foundational functionality, you're gonna have the most reach, which is the superpower of the web, is its reach. That, regardless of screen size, device type, or network speed, somebody could accomplish their goal. But like I said, the key thing is you don't stop there, that you then continue to evolve and enhance. But you're kind of doing it in a safe way then. You're doing it in a way that can always fall back to something more universal.
So you're going, but you're iterating on that fidelity. You're going higher and higher
Exactly.
fidelity instead of saying like, okay, let's build this feature in its entirety and then feature factory style, like, okay, ship that on to the next feature and then like never think about that feature ever again. And potentially
Yeah.
never test it even. But I'm really happy to hear what you said about design systems because and how object-oriented UX can kind of work with a design system. And so hearkening, I had a conversation earlier this year with Dan Moll about this and how OUX can sort of be the precursor to a design system as it like it provides the instructions for the design system. And really that's what an object map is. It's a text base. It's all text and color coding to
Yeah.
say, here's what the things are. Here's the purpose of these things. Here's like the real world objects. So when we talk about objects in OUX, we're not talking about components. We're not talking about drop downs and nav bars. We're talking about what are the things that people are actually coming for. So it's the
And I would say
event,
that
right?
that part of it, the instructions, that's the system part of a design system. If what you have is a whole bunch of components that have been built, you've got a component library, you've got a pattern library. It's not a design system because the system is how those components work together, how I use them, when I use them. So, I mean, I talked about this kind of thought experiment, which was, let's say you've got a pattern library of components, and from one day to the next, you've got a choice. Like, either the library disappears, so the code's no longer there, the designs are no longer there, but everyone retains the cultural knowledge of how to use components, how the components fit together. Or your component library is still there the next day, but everyone suffered amnesia and no longer knows how to use those components. Like, which would be preferable? Which would be worse? And I kind of feel like you want to be in an organization where you could lose the actual artifacts, but still retain the system part, and you could rebuild it. Whereas if you suddenly given a whole bunch of components, going, there's your design system, with no idea of how it fits together, how they're supposed to be used, I'm not sure that's useful. I mean, I can go online and find somebody else's design system. It doesn't help my organization, right?
So a metaphor that I use is, and I love that. Like, do you want to lose the institutional knowledge on how these components actually come together to create valuable things that the user actually wants information about and wants to interact with? Or do you lose that Figma file or that sketch file? Much rather you lose the sketch file for sure. So coming back to this idea of complexity and how things what we tend to do as human beings as things get more and more complex, they tend to get more and more fragile. And we end up in this this sort of world where like I guess going back to what you were saying about the early pushback to CSS, and so in the book you were talking about people when CSS was first emerging onto the scene, and then responsive design emerging onto the scene, there was a lot of pushback from the community on like, oh, this'll work for somebody's personal website, but this would never scale. Yes. Which seems crazy to think about in retrospect, like, because the opposite of styling through HTML hacks or building a bunch of MDOT sites, I like building separate sites, which when I started at CNN, that's what we had three different versions of the site. And it was an absolute nightmare, and we could see the unscalability of it. So I guess, what is going on here? Like, why do you think that is? Why do you think as human beings, we tend to, and it kind of goes back to what you were saying about this place of comfort of like, let me just see this thing and I will build this thing and ship this thing. But I guess if you could get into what you think actually is happening within organizations and what we can do about it as designers, how can we kind of push back on that?
So there's a bit of a paradox here, because on the one hand, yes, I'm pointing to inertia and saying it's a very powerful force in human nature. So if people have already figured out how to make websites using tables for layouts and then CSS comes along, why should I use CSS? I already know how to make websites using tables for layout. People know how to make fixed width websites and then responsive design comes along. Why should I use responsive design? I already know how to make fixed width websites. And I think I quoted Grace Hopper in the book who said, you know, the most dangerous phrase in English language is we've always done it that way. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, I'm saying we need to be open to adapting and changing our ways. And yet, on the other hand, I'm also saying when you're deciding on the foundational technologies to use for your core functionality, go to the old stuff, go to the boring stuff, go to the stuff that's been around for years. So I'm almost advocating for inertia at the foundational level. But then when it comes to layering on those features, I'm kind of saying, and that's where you should go nuts and try the latest browser features. Try this new API that just landed that's only supported in one browser. That you should do that because it's safe to do it if you're building in a layered way. So there's a bit of a contradiction in what I'm saying, because I'm giving different advice at different layers. So at the foundational layer, the slow moving kind of, this is the stuff that matters. I'm saying go boring, stick with the tried and trusted technologies. And at the features level that the user's going to interact with, you want to delight them. I'm saying move fast and like try the latest and greatest and get in there. Mm-hmm. The problem I see is when things get reversed in either direction. Mm-hmm. So you see people building their foundational stuff using some latest and greatest technology that's only supported in a handful of browsers and devices. Like, that's not smart. I advise you to have more inertia in that situation. But then I also see people not embracing the latest technologies, the latest possibilities in browsers, because they say, well, you know, we've got these customers on these older browsers and we want to give them exactly the same experience as these customers on the newest browsers. And to them, I think, well, you've got too much inertia and you should be embracing these latest and greatest things. And it won't harm those other customers, by the way. They'll just get the more foundational experience, and that's fine. So there is a bit of a paradox, what I'm saying. I think I advocate inertia at one level and I advocate experimentation at another. And the problem is when I see people being too experimental at the foundational level or being too conservative at the features level.
I mean, and those that paradox does sort of sit well in my brain. It doesn't feel like these things are sort of mutually exclusive. Like, we can do them both. But what we want to do is we want to experiment and use that latest and greatest technology without sacrificing the core functionality. It should never be a sacrifice. And I see that not only from a technology, you're seeing it from the technology perspective. I'm seeing it from a user experience perspective of, for example, the latest update of Camtasia. I mean, Camtasia has serious performance issues. It has an issue where a known issue, like I've gone on their website and they have marked this as a known issue where audio and video syncing gets off. And this is like the one thing that it's a webcam recorder. One of their core pieces of functionality should be syncing audio and video. So I'm not having to go in there and resync audio and video so that my mouth, I don't look like I'm dubbed or something, you know? And yet they make a new release and they haven't fixed that problem. They are instead introducing new animations that you can add into your videos. They're adding new bells and whistles. And I see that so many times in companies. Evernote's new update. They did a lot of new visual, it like looks better visually. And I can no longer export my images to a folder. So I'm using the legacy Evernote right now because core functionality went away while the new, you know, I guess they have a new visual design system now and they got their new visual design system. I can't even rotate an image. I can't right click and rotate an image anymore. So I'm using the legacy Evernote. So again, coming back to like organizational structure and like, and when you're in it and when you're the designer in it and you're seeing either other designers or your project manager kind of pushing you away from figuring out that core functionality and fixing what people that, you know, the 80% that people are coming for. Do you have any advice for people that are dealing with that?
I think this speaks to what I was saying earlier about this bias towards the visible that we have. Mm-hmm. And this is, it's partly organizational, but I think it's also human nature. You know, you can see when somebody's rolled out a new animation, you can see when somebody's rolled out a new visual design upgrade, but a lot of the important stuff is invisible, accessibility, speed, you know, just performance, that core functionality. And it's hard to prioritize the invisible. It's hard to put that into a Jira ticket or a Trello card, right? Because I can't look at it. I can't see what it's about, you know, how this improved performance is supposed to look, how this improved accessibility appears, because it doesn't. These things are under the hood. So that's, I think, that's at the core of it. And also another reason why I advocate building in this layered way is that you don't end up in a situation where you've built on something shaky and now you got to go back and try and fix the fundamentals. That's actually really, really hard. And mm-hmm. I will acknowledge that a lot of the advice that I give in resilient web design is imagining that you're building something from scratch, that you're building something new. It is a lot harder to recognize that, oh, our foundations are fundamentally, you know, rotten and we need to go back in and fix them. That's really hard without just, you know, completely starting from scratch. And again, that's true when it comes to the invisible stuff you can't see, the performance, the accessibility, mm-hmm. security, things that aren't, you know, at that interface level. It's tricky.
I mean, even information architecture often feels too abstract for people to kind of prioritize that information architecture and realize that, like, our rooms aren't in the right place. That's a really hard thing to go fix.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to write a press release that says, you know, go come and look at our new information architecture, because mm-hmm. there's nothing to look at. It's a, you know, it's a structure. It's not visible.
So what I'm hearing is if we can make that more visible, if we can have some sort of artifacts to make those issues visible to the decision makers, and maybe even tie that to some sort of just to metrics and to actual business needs.
Yeah, and this is something that people talk about a lot in worlds of accessibility and performance, for example, which to me, these things tie in very much with this idea of resilience and what you're building, this layered approach, you know, get the fundamentals right and then layer on enhancements. And so people have all sorts of advice about how to make bad performance visible. That you can look at numbers and metrics and you go into the meeting and you try and show, you know, a bar chart or something. But what I found more useful is to try and almost get to the brainstem and you know, is there a more emotional way of doing this? This is why, you know, it's always good to have the boss in a usability testing session, because they see the frustration. You know, it's not just a report then. It's not just a number. It's like, oh, that person is suffering because our interface is like letting them down. So things like, just to use the performance example, there's a tool, Web Page Test, which is very useful. You run your website through it, you get all the numbers, da da da. But one of the other things you can get out of it is video of what your website loading on a small screen on a bad connection is like. And what I found works nicely is you put your website through there. You also put your competitor's website through that. And then you run the videos side by side. You don't even have to say anything. You just show it. And that speaks volumes, I think, because then it's a more an emotional gut punch to see, oh, we're really, trailing behind. So making the invisible visible somehow is hard. I think numbers only go so far, statistics, all that kind of stuff. Trying to find a story that's tied to actual user frustration or pain should go further, unless, your boss is a psychopath, in which case there's not much you can do.
Yeah, and those guys are out there, definitely. those psychopathic bosses. So I just to add to everything you said, so one thing that we do with object mapping is it's usually a collaborative session. So I always recommend having our stakeholders in that session. So they are also identifying that complexity that sometimes, it's so weird. Sometimes we as humans, we make things too complicated. We overcomplicate things in one area. And then in some areas, we just like to gloss over the complexity and just sweep it under the rug and say, like, ah, we'll figure that out in visual design, or we'll figure that out. Like our design system will take care of that. So the object mapping is a really great way to actually bring our stakeholders in, bring our developers in, bring the entire cross-functional team together to really lay the complexity on the table and understand where the pieces don't really fit together. Yeah.
Do you bring in end users, customers into that as well? Get their perspective.
Yes, I have before. It's a hard sell, as always. But yeah, one of my best sessions was with Delta, and we were I, they flew in 25 users, because Delta, I guess, can do that. But they were actually travel agents. So they were travel agents using Delta business tools. And so we had 25 folks in the room, split them up into five groups of five, and I just made them do it. I just taught them how to basically build a system model, basically an entity relationship diagram. Like, let's figure out, like, what are the entities here? And then, oh, okay. So you have an agency and an incentive home, and some people are saying an incentive home and an agency are the same thing, and some of you are saying that an agency has many incentive homes, and some of you are saying that an incentive home has many agencies. So, like, let's have a conversation about this. What is an incentive home? What is an agency, and how do they relate to each other? So just getting them to sort of draw out those fundamental building blocks of what this system is, those fundamental concepts, and like, do we all have the same idea in our head about what those things are? And getting, again, like, going back to that foundation, that we can build upon that foundation, so we don't build a bunch of UI and realize that, oh, the relationship between an incentive home and an agency is actually different than what we thought it was.
So this sounds to me like it comes back to mental models, the kind of stuff that Indy Young talks about a lot. And because we have this at Clear Left as well, where on a like there's a project right now, and this week we're talking to stakeholders, hugely valued, very much in the divergent phase of like where we're gathering, as much as we can from them. But crucially, next week we talk to customers, we're doing user research with them, and we'll gather as much from them as we can as well. And it's almost trying to match up both of those mental models, because the stakeholders might have a very different mental model of things than the users. And it's hard work, but I feel like it's if you only did one and not the other, you'd only be getting like one person's retelling of the story.
I mean, exactly. That's a big part of the work that we do in OUX is figuring out what is the business model. The business process model, not necessarily the monetization model, but like that's a piece of it too. But like, what are the things as far as what is valuable to the business, and what are the things that are valuable to the users? And hopefully there's like pretty good alignment there. And what I found is usually it's just the words, it's labeling. It's like, oh, you call it this and you call it that. It's the same thing, really, but you're just calling it different things. Like, let's just call it what the
90% of
users
you,
call it.
90% of usability testing in my experience is uncovering issues with labeling.
Yeah. And
Like if
just,
you'd called it this other word, I would have found what I was looking for straight away. Okay, super valuable. 5 minutes of usability testing, we've found the problem. It's labeling.
One thing we use Trello a lot actually to build the object map. So not actually for project management, but to say, okay, every column is an object, and then we put the data structure as attributes in cards. And often these cards have connections or kind of conditional logic. So like if product type is digital versus physical, if it's digital, it's going to get these attributes. If the product is physical, it's going to get these attributes. So some sort of like conditional logic that we have to reconcile, or different states of, if the article is in draft, it'll have these pieces. But if the article is submitted, all of a sudden it'll have like an approver object connected to it. So one thing that we were struggling with is kind of connecting the cards. And I was looking at power-ups and all these things, like how do we say that these two cards are connected to each other or sort of dependent on each other? And it actually, somebody in the certification program found that it comes default. You don't need a power-up at all to connect cards in Trello, but they have it under attachments. So you do attachments, and then one of the options for attachments is another Trello card. And I was thinking, I never would have thought about that, because
Right,
when I think
because of
about an
labeling.
attachment, I think about attaching something external to the system, not something within the system. And that just made me pause and think, how do I think about the word attachment? What does that mean to me? And this is, we've had so many people go through this course, and nobody's figured that out. Until this one wonderful woman figured out, like, oh, I can find it under attachments,
So
labeling
this
issue.
question of labeling and language, shared language, I guess. This comes up a lot in design systems as well. So here we're not talking about anything that's ever going to be seen by end users. This is, internally, you've got a design system, you've got these components. What those components are called can make such a difference to whether the design system will get used or not. This is why I find whoever's going to be using the design system needs to be involved in the creation of the design system. At the very least, involved in the naming of these components, because otherwise there's kind of this feeling of like, why wasn't I consulted? Why are you calling it this? I would have called it something else. A colleague of mine a few years ago, Charlotte, she had this exercise she would do, again, bringing in everybody, not just, the designers, but, developers, other stakeholders, content people, whoever, and, cut up an interface, find similar components, group them together. So this is like your classic, inventory of interface elements. But then here's the crucial bit. We kind of played post-it note poker with what would you call this? So everyone writes on a post-it note what they would call it, and it's like, okay, 3, 2, 1, everyone show your cards. And if everyone's written the same thing, it's like, great, we've nailed it. This is clearly the name of this component is what we've all written down. But it's obviously more interesting when there's different competing words, like, oh, really? Why do you call it that? What's your thinking there? And you uncover these mental models. You uncover, well, I was imagining that this is part of this other thing, or I was imagining it belongs to this category of things. And actually, the conversation you then have is probably more important than whatever the final name ends up being. It's the fact that everyone was involved, everyone contributed, everyone was in that discussion. And even if the name you chose isn't the final name, you were there when that discussion happened. You understand the reasoning, you understand why it's called the thing it's called now. So this shared understanding of vocabulary seems, again, going back to what we're saying earlier about design systems, I almost feel like it's more important than what the final co code or design is does everyone understand what this component is? When I say the name of this component, do you know how to use it? Do you know what it's for? Do you know what its purpose is? It's something that Alla Kolmatova wrote a whole book on design systems, really good book. She talked about that fun, and it just goes back to the resilient web design thing, asking yourself, what is the purpose of this? What is its meaning in life, right? Why does this thing exist? And having a name that reflects that purpose will then, I think, make or break whether that design system ends up being used.
I couldn't agree more, and I always say, like, when I see design systems that have components, especially those cards or tiles that are like sidebar card or home, this is the home page tile. And I'm like, oh, its purpose is to be on the home page. Great. That's what its purpose is. It's to just to sit on the homepage. That's a means to an end. Like what is the actual purpose of this thing? So what I advocate is actually naming your components by object. Surprise, surprise. So it's not your homepage title. It's your event card. And it might, if it's an event that you're representing, okay, we have an event card. We can figure out what it, if that sketch file disappears, we still know we need an event card, and we know that it needs a start time, an end time, an image, maybe if people are looking at it. But you know, if they're hearing it through Alexa, they still need that start time and end time. It needs a location, and it needs a short description. So we know the structure of what an event is, and we know we have an event, and maybe it's going to show up on the homepage. Maybe it's going to show up on an event listing page. Maybe it's going to be in a flyout on some sort of venue page or something like that. Who knows? But this like tying, it's basically the tying of presentation to how we're naming stuff. Hey y'all, just a quick interruption. As of this recording, we are in the midst of cohort 4 of the OUX certification, and enrollment for cohort 5 won't open up until early summer 2021. But you can dig into all the certification video content, all the templates, all the resources, by grabbing access to the OUX Masterclass. And if, after going through the Masterclass, you want to get certified, you'll be able to apply the cost of the Masterclass to your enrollment in Cohort 5. So you can kind of think about it like a down payment. Once you enroll in the Masterclass, you'll get access to the OUX Academy, and over the course of 10 weeks, about 2 to 3 hours of video lectures will be released to you each week. But you can consume that content totally at your own pace. You'll have lifetime access to it. So if it takes you 20 weeks to go through it, that's totally fine. You're not just gonna get video content. You're gonna get checklists. You're gonna get exercises. You're gonna get assignments and tons of valuable resources. Basically everything you need to become an expert complexity wrangler. Again, you get everything that a certification cohort gets, just minus all those personal touches. The camaraderie of the cohort in the OUX forum, access to the OUX mentors, the one-on-ones with me, as well as me answering all your questions in the forum and in office hours, and of course the actual certification and a profile on OUX.com. So for all of that, you'll need to actually join a cohort. But you don't have to wait. You can start becoming that complexity wrangling, stakeholder whispering, IA facilitator extraordinaire now. You can start saving yourself and your team countless hours of rework, and you can start saving your user from the extraneous complexity that OUX helps you avoid. So go to OUX.com/certification to learn more. From there, you can get on the waitlist for cohort 5, as well as get yourself access to that entire video library that is the OUX Masterclass. Still not sure if you're ready to take the plunge? Go check out the testimonials on OUX.com. Okay, back to the show. So I actually have a question that I have, a super practical question that I had for you, is about naming your CSS classes. because this is something that I'm dealing with right now. There's naming your design system, and then also naming your classes and saying like, okay, naming a class that says, oh, this is left aligned 20 pixel margin as a class, or blue button. What are your, and I would like to see like kind of how you recommend naming design system components and how that might work with how you actually name and organize your CSS classes.
So there is a connection there. And I would say, you know, first of all, you do the exercises around what is this component, what's its purpose. And through that, with everyone involved, you get a name for that component. And that's pretty foundational. And probably whatever that name is going to be the base class of of that component. Like if it's an event card, then maybe that's the base class name for the container. Now then, how do you name all the things within it that need to be styled? So how do you name start time? How do you name end time? What do you call the image? Blah, blah, blah. I've used the BEM naming methodology, BEM, block element modifier, which isn't advocating specific words. It's advocating a structure for how you kind of put those words together. So it would be like event card dash start time, event card dash end time, and so on. And that works pretty well, I would say. It's pretty robust. But there's been, so that was kind of, I guess, the way things were done for a while. And then there was a real pushback against that. And these days, there's a trend to go the exact opposite and just go, oh, we have a class called 20 pixels left, or a class called, you know, blue, red, whatever, 2 pix red border or something, and you just slap that on everything. Which to my mind is like, well, you might as well be using inline styles at that point. Which the response is, ah, no, but this is a constrained set of class names that, so you can't use anything that has to be in the set. It's like, well, if you're in a culture that's going to stick to that constrained set of names, you could also just have a, you'd have also in a culture that would stick to a constrained set of inline styles. Basically, I don't think it works for everything. I do think they can work for what are called utility classes. So that's almost for the stuff between components. So spacing and, you know, gaps and things like that. I think it can be useful to have a class name that describes what it does, you know, 20 pixel gap, or I'd still shudder to use something that specific. I'd probably go like, you know, medium or large or small or so on and so on. But this question of what to name things in HTML, because the classes are in HTML, not in CSS, is as old as time itself. I mean, this is a discussion we've had since the early days of the web. You know, how you do you use a vocabulary? Should we all agree on using the same vocabulary, building different sites? Should your vocabulary be specific to the kind of website you're building? It's an interesting discussion, and I think I probably felt stronger about it in the past. Ultimately, though, and this kind of is true of design systems in general too, this is something that happens internally. It's something to do with your organization. It's to do with your own culture and what works for you. So I don't think, you know, I might think in a certain way, I might have a particular philosophy around naming things, but if I'm the outlier and actually everyone else in the organization thinks a different way, I should get on board with how they think. It's kind of like, you know, should we use tabs or spaces for our indenting code? It's like whatever the majority thinks is the correct answer there. It's like you go with whatever's best for everyone. And it's sometimes useful to step back and think, does any of this actually have an impact on the end user experience directly? And the answer is no. I mean, much as I hate, and I love design systems, I love all that, it doesn't actually have a direct impact on the end user experience. It gets knock-on impact with consistency, and hopefully you can build faster and the end user gets new features faster. But I do try to keep a perspective and say maybe our energy is better spent on thinking about the end user.
So I will, to play the devil's advocate there, I would say that there are things that do impact the end user as well, and also resiliency, as far as if you have a different class for everything, if you have, then updating becomes hard. And you could very well end up with different styles that represent the same thing, which actually increases cognitive load on the user. So I could have, I have two, let's say I have two different event cards. I have maybe like a table view, like a row view of the event card if I'm like want it in a kind of a scannable state. And then I also have maybe like a little like a flyout view. And it's the same data, but I've just sort of squished things around a little bit. So I need different padding, I need different ways of arranging the elements within that event card. But let's say I have a style for that timestamp, for that in let's say in start time and end time. So I have event timestamp as a class. And then I go, but then I have it actually a different, I have event timestamp for the table, and then I have event timestamp for the flyout. And then when I change it, I decide I want to change that to pink. It only is going to change in one place. It's not going to change in both those places. It doesn't nicely update, right? And so now what I end up with is if I'm not very cognizant of it, and if I change it in one place, it's not going to change in the other place. And now what I end up is I end up with that inconsistency where timestamp is pink in one place, but then the user goes into another place and the timestamp is black. And the thing is, what we do as human beings is if we see a difference, we're going to attribute meaning to that difference. And even if there's absolutely no meaning to that difference, we might think like, what does it mean when the timestamp is in pink? Or it just makes the timestamp a little bit more difficult to recognize and find because we're used to seeing it in pink and now we see it in black. Or...
I'm going to play devil's advocate to your devil's advocate.
All right.
And I agree with you that the consistency for the end user is what's important. So picture this. You've got two event cards and they are completely consistent in terms of how they look. The timestamps on both are the same colors. They've got the same spacing. Great. Under the hood, they've both been coded in completely different ways. One of them uses these classes, one of them using a completely different system, different classes. Now, clearly that's a problem, but it's not a problem for the end user. That's an organizational problem. You got some mm-hmm. serious issues with how you're pushing code out, and that kind of inconsistency, you know, makes programmers shudder, and I can see why you want to unify it and get it into a design system. But for the end user, apart from, okay, there's maybe a little bit of a performance hit that the style sheet's probably bigger than it needs to be because you're duplicating styles, but you know, it's probably not the biggest performance issue you've got. So I would say that you're absolutely right to say that the consistency for the end user is what matters. I think a lot of the effort we put into design systems is about consistency for the developers, consistency for how we make things, and we lose sight of the thing that really matters, which is the end user's perspective.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's one of those things that for sure, if we can mitigate those internal issues so that they don't trickle down to the end user, then we're fine. But then it comes to be the problem of like, what happens when we don't mitigate that? And what happens when we're too disorganized? And then and the inconsistencies that were great for a developer, then are the inconsistencies that, you know, or make life hard for the developer or make life hard for the designer end up just this the shit doesn't get done. And then you just end up having those inconsistencies. So I want to actually bring up another paradox that I've seen that I agree with, and it sits well in my head, but I can see some people maybe saying that this is oxymoronic. So the I'm going to butcher the name, Eliel Saarinen quote, that you have in your book. I was excited to hear that. I have that in my presentation as well. So this quote, this is from an architect, Eliel Saarinen, says, am I pronouncing it correctly? Do you know?
I do not speak Finnish. I do not know.
I think it's Saarinen, Eliel Saarinen. So Eliel says, always design a thing by considering its next larger context, a chair in a room in a house in an environment in a city plan. And I 100% agree that when we're designing a product, we always need to think about what is the larger context? And if we can even go two levels out. And Andrew Hinton talks about this in his book, Understanding Context. I'm right there. So how do we actually kind of balance that wider view as well as that focused view of core functionality and core information? So, you know, with this whole idea of progressive enhancement, it all comes back to prioritizing and saying, okay, this is the core functionality. We need to figure out what is that core functionality, and in a way, kind of like put our blinders on for a moment and say, like, let's just make this work. Let's just make sure that audio and video is synced up before we build more animations, right? While also sort of seeing this is where we want to be in 18 months. This is where we want to be in 5 years, because this is how our system fits into this wider, larger system. And this is how we see ourselves growing. So how do we kind of reconcile growth and kind of a plan for the future so that the work that we do, that foundational work that we do, we're not kind of painting ourselves into a corner. We're building a foundation that is going to serve the long-term vision.
And I would say that this is a question that it's true of design in general. And as you progress in design, it's a skill that becomes more and more important, is these different these levels of perspective, this idea that, you know, you begin and you're probably at the coal face, you know, you're chipping away at pixels, and that's your perspective. And as you progress, you start to get access to the wider and wider view, and you start to think in longer and longer timescales, till, you know, you're managing a team and you're going from a meeting where you're at the 10,000 foot view, and you're looking at projections and forecasts for the next 18 months. And then you're talking to somebody who wants your opinion on whether this pixel is in the right place. And you're back in the coalface. And there's all sorts of levels in between that ground level view and that 10,000 foot view. And it's not easy to switch those contexts and to be able to zoom in, to be able to zoom out. and tie it all together. What I would say is this mindset that I'm advocating, this kind of X-ray vision layered approach, that one of the nice things about it is that it is scale-free. As in, you can ask it at the biggest level, you can say, what is the core functionality of our business? What is it we provide to users? And then go through the steps of saying, okay, well, now what's the simplest technology, the oldest, most boring technology we can use to provide that core functionality? You've built in the resilience, you're providing the universality. And then you start thinking about the features, something about how to enhance until you're at the latest and greatest cutting edge technology for your company's functionality. So it works at that level. So that's kind of like the 10,000 foot view. But you can also zoom into a component and say, okay, so this is an event card, like we're talking about. What's its purpose? It needs to convey some core information, the name of the event, start time, the end time. Okay, what's the most simple technology to do that? Plain text. All right, how can we enhance? And then you start, well, we could have a calendar in here, you know, could have an option to download this to your calendar. We could have a map here. Could be a plain image. Oh, let's enhance the map. It could be a slippy map. It could have all these other things. So now you're at the coal face, but you're using the same technique. You're using the same mindset to think, what's the core functionality? How do I provide that functionality with the most boring technology? Now, how do I enhance that functionality? And it works at all those levels. You can do it at the component level, the page level, the section level, the website level, the company level. And it's a pretty good way of thinking at all those scales.
Yeah, even the industry level. What are we actually trying to do here as an industry?
What is our purpose in life?
Yeah, I mean, it can't, like, going up to that, you know, what is the core thing that we are trying to do here? And then step it back, and then enhance. So when it comes to prioritization, how do you, and figuring out that core functionality, how much, again, do you kind of like take that wider view to figure out what to prioritize? So for some context, one thing that we do, we kind of go through these iterations of what I call the ORCA process, which is objects, relationships, CTAs, and attributes. And we sort of iterate on those. Okay, what are the things? How do all those things connect to each other? What do users want to do to those things? And what are the attributes? What are those things made up of? What is the data model for each of those things? And we start really wide. We take a kind of a wide look and we figure out there might be 10 or 12 objects, and we figure out all the relationships, and we get into requirements, and we figure out the mechanics of those relationships. And we ask for every single call to action. We think about why the user is actually doing it and when they're doing it in the journey. So we get, like, you know, purpose and context for every single CTA. And then we go through a prioritization round. So we sort of take this big view. Okay, this is where we might want to be, and like, this might take 24 months to develop. Like, okay, no, we don't want to take 24 months to develop. Now let's kill some darlings. And so, and some of the feedback that I get is, like, oh, it feels like, why can't we prioritize earlier? As in, you know, like a week earlier, without doing all this extra, you know, thinking about the wider view. And my argument for that is we have to understand the things to know how to prioritize the things. So again, like, how does that fit into your philosophy, or does it conflict with your philosophy of figuring out that core functionality is? Like, where in your process do you cast the wider net, so to speak?
So where it happens for me is that it's with design principles, which I think are a great medium for prioritization. I think most design principles are terrible. You know, companies publish them and they're just platitudes. But when used well, they are a scalpel for priorities. So to map to what you were talking about, the big picture view and then down at the coalface, and kind of to that Aleel Saarinen quote as well about the different contexts, I always think about values, principles, and patterns. And each one depends on the one before. So your values is like your company. What's the purpose of your company? This is the big picture stuff, the 10,000 foot view. You know, why does your company even exist? What's your organization for? And you should hopefully all have agreement. You got, you know, your mission statement on that. And then that should inform your design principles. And your design principles, I think, are all about priorities. Like a good design principle says X even over Y. We prioritize this even over. We're not saying we don't think Y is important, but at this organization, we think X is more important. Mm-hmm. And a good test for whether it's a useful design principle is it reversible? If I went to a different organization, would they be saying Y even over X? And if they would, and they're like, good, then that's a genuine prioritization. Like my favorite design principle comes from the HTML design principles, where it's users even over implementers, even over specifiers, something like that. Basically, it lists out the priorities of who to consider when designing something. And then that's where your priorities live. And then those should influence the patterns. And the patterns are the components, the actual structures, the interface that the end user will interact with. So the user interacts with a widget on your website that's informed by design principles, which encode priorities, that's informed by the company's vision. So you can step back and step back and step back from one interface to the reason why this company exists. And there's a through line throughout it. And so then when you're at the coalface and you're making those patterns, you can refer to the design principle. There's a disagreement, say. And this is what I think design principles are for resolving conflict. Someone says, I think we should do X, and someone says, I think we should do Y. Well, let's go to the design principles, which we've all previously agreed on. And what would the design principles, you know, advise us to prioritize in this situation? And it also helps take the ego out of things. It stops being about one person's opinion versus another. And it's more about, well, we all agreed that we at this company prioritize these things over these other things. So design principles, because they sit at that middle space between the 10,000 foot view of our values and the coalface view of the interface components, I think it's important to try and get them right and to test them and revisit them and use them as a means to resolve conflict and to prioritize. That's what they're for, is I think it's about prioritization.
So one of the, I feel like one of, and correct me if I'm wrong, don't let me put words in your mouth, but one of your principles is about democratizing the web and making it accessible to everyone, not just to access the information, but to share their own information, and sort of be platform agnostic even. One thing that hit home for me is like you saying that you're advocating people sharing, but sharing on their own site specifically. Yes. Not sharing on, you know, Medium or LinkedIn, because then you're putting your content in somebody in a platform's hands, which I've got some work to do in that department, I guess. But I'm wondering how that sort of balances with some of these no code tools out there. So Webflow, Adalo, even like building with Airtable and Glide, and some of these things that are helping democratize, basically putting designing websites and apps in more people's hands. But you are definitely tied to a platform. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm generally in favor of these tools, especially the ones that allow you to, you know, you have your domain name, mm-hmm, and you own that. Now, then you might use a tool like Squarespace, for example, to build the website that you put on that domain. And you pay them money to do that. And I'm all for that. I mean, I think that is great, because the reason why people end up using services like Medium or Twitter or whatever, these silos or Facebook, whatever, is the convenience. It's frankly, you don't want to have to learn how to make a website and launch pages and the technical side of things. It is still, the barrier to entry is still unfortunately too high. So anything that does democratize that is great in my book. I think it goes too far when it's like, oh yes, you can do that, but it has to be on our domain. You have to do it on facebook.com. Mm-hmm. You have to do it on medium.com, because then you're handing over ownership of that stuff to them. And if they decide to throw it away or do something nefarious with it, you can't really argue with them. You chose to pitch your tent in their front yard. But these other tools that are more about, you know, helping you build something on your domain, I might quibble with the code quality, and you know, I might want to make sure that the output is accessible and performant, right, and all that, but that's me with my developer hat on. From a philosophical point of view, yeah, anything that helps people publish on their own domain is good with me.
And that's why you use Webflow and not Squarespace, because the code will definitely be cleaner. So it's
I
cool.
do what nobody should do, and I hand code it. So I wouldn't recommend that for anyone.
Well, so it sounds like it's cool that OAUX.com is on Webflow, but we should be moving everything that's being published on Medium should be published on our own domain.
Well, why not both? What I do is when I publish a blog post on my site, adactio.com, I syndicate it to mm-hmm. Medium. I also have a link on Medium that says, like, this is originally published on my own website. So but the copy lives on Medium. Same with my tweets. Whenever you see a tweet from me, that started on my own website, and I put a copy of it on Twitter. Yeah. And that changes your relationship then. These things are just syndication endpoints for your content, but the canonical home for everything you put out there is on your domain, and that gives you a different feeling. It's very empowering.
Yeah, I can see that would totally change the dynamic and how you think about your own content. Awesome. So, Jeremy, what's next for you? What are you working on right now?
Well, at Clear Left, we put on events. In the before times, they would have been wonderful physical events, and we would gather together in the same physical location. That's not happening, but we are continuing to put on events, pivoting to online events. And one that's coming up is UX Fest. This is the online version of UX London, which has been running for many years now. And that's happening in June. It's got an amazing lineup. It's going to be fantastic. But my role will be to be the host, to be the compere. So be introducing the speakers. I will be interviewing them after their talks and all of that. So my headspace right now is very much in stalking those speakers, getting to know their brains, understanding the points they're making, and so I can come up, so I can be a good host when I welcome them to the conference. So that's what I'm like literally right now thinking about and stuff. But the other thing I've been working on recently is in your domain, which is podcasting. I've started a Clear Left podcast. Not like this, where it's, you know, we're having a conversation and it's a deep dive. This is a bit more quick bites of stuff strung together into some thematic whole. So that's at podcast.clearleft.com. A lot of work, but good fun.
That's awesome. Well, we'll definitely link to all of those wonderful things. And thank you. Thank you for being you. Thank you for all the work that you're doing. Thank you for Resilient Web Design. Now that we're wrapping this up, everybody that's listening, please go check out Resilient Web Design, have a listen. Yeah, thanks so much, Jeremy.
Thank you very much for having me, Sophia.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!